Welcome to a podcast for everyone. Practical conversations answering your questions about how to make websites and mobile apps work for everyone. This podcast series is brought to you by UIE's All You Can Learn, Rosenfeld Media, the Passiella Group, and O'Reilly. Today, Sarah Horton will be talking to Steve Faulkner about HTML5.
Hi, I'm Sarah Horton, and I'm co-author with Whitney Quisenberry of A Web for Everyone with Rosenfeld Media. I'm here today with Steve Faulkner. Steve is my friend and colleague. He is technical director with the Passiella Group. Before joining TPG, he worked as an accessibility consultant with Vision Australia. Steve has been a mentor for me since I started working in accessibility. Much of what I know about accessibility, I learned from Steve. In addition to his day job, Steve is an active participant in key W3C initiatives promoting web accessibility. His tireless work has led to key accessibility resources, including the very helpful Techniques for Providing Useful Text Alternatives document. As co-editor of the HTML5 specification, much of his current work is focused on ensuring the specification moves forward in a way that supports and extends all the great work that's been done to bring accessibility to the web. We're here to learn from Steve about the status of the specification and whether there are changes we should anticipate as the spec is approved and implemented. We also want to get a sense for what it's like to work on a spec and how accessibility concerns are addressed in that process. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's start by talking about how you got involved in accessibility in the first place.
In the late 90s, I became involved in doing some HTML development. It was at a time where if you could spell HTML, then you could get a job as a HTML coder. And I did some work over here in the UK. I was in the UK at the time. I did some work over here. And then when I decided to go back to Australia, which is my home country, I looked for a job, and there was a job at Vision Australia. At that point, I didn't have any idea about accessibility, really. I had very little knowledge. But I had an interest in working with people with disabilities and aged people, which I'd done previous to starting to do the HTML development. I did a degree in psychology, and I just gravitate towards sort of social work type career path, I suppose you could say. But it interested me to be able to combine both the technical aspects, which is the HTML development work, and working with people with disabilities and hopefully making a positive difference. When I started the job, as I said, I didn't know anything about accessibility, and this was around 2000, and it was at a time where the accessibility field was still in its infancy, I suppose you could say. Although, I mean, it probably wasn't an infant, but it was probably more of a toddler. Anyway, my first day on the job, my then boss, Andrew Arch, threw a copy of the WCAG 1 guidelines at me and said, "Learn this." And so that's where I started, auditing and reviewing websites for accessibility against the WCAG 1.0 guidelines.
And so did you read the guidelines from beginning to end? And
yes, I did. In those days, there wasn't a lot of the resources that are available now, you know, 13, 14 years later. And so it was pretty much a sort of, you know, explore and find out. And also, there wasn't the community that we have today through Twitter and Facebook and all those sort of things as well. I mean, there were mailing lists and there was WCAG, the Web Accessibility Initiative, but those were not exactly as user-friendly as the sort of informal networks that have grown up over time.
So when you think about the changes from WCAG 1 and now, and also the kind of issues that you were encountering when you were auditing things back then, are you seeing different types of issues, and are things getting better? Are they worse, or both?
Well, obviously we're seeing different types of issues in that the interactions and processes that we regularly encounter, you know, websites and web applications are much more complex than they were at that point. I mean, we weren't dealing with a static web at that point, but we were dealing with the web that was a lot more server-side functionality. So a lot of the processing went on the server side. You know, you'd fill in a form, you'd input it, and then you'd get some results sent back, for example. But these days, everything happens, you know, in the browser, or, you know, a lot of things happen in the browser, and the sort of user interface elements that you're dealing with are often these sort of, you could describe them as a house of cards built in HTML, and they often don't have the required accessibility information, such as the role states and properties, and they don't work correctly with the keyboard or work as expected. They do, you know, things look like a button, but you can't use it with the keyboard, for example. Whereas in the older days, when people stuck more to using the basic native HTML controls, it was a bit easier in that sense. And also the complexity of the content in general was less problematic. Because it was less complex, there was less things to go wrong. So I suppose back to your question, are things getting better or worse? Well, as complexity increases, then obviously new issues arise. But at the same time, there's a lot more awareness these days about accessibility, and there's a lot of information out there to be able to draw upon, to be able to fix issues, and also developers in general are more aware of taking into account building usable and accessible interfaces from the get-go, rather than having to come back and add this stuff in all the time, even though that we still do encounter that a lot.
So then things are getting worse in the sense that the interfaces are getting more complex and more difficult to support and code accessibly, but you're also seeing at the same time a lot more awareness on the developer end of things and also more resources to support accessible coding practices.
Yeah, I would generally agree with what you've just said, except that I don't think they're becoming more difficult to make accessible, because the tools that we have available now, which is such as the ARIA, the Accessible Rich Internet Applications specification, and the features that that describes that are implemented in browsers, make it a lot easier and possible to make more complex user interface elements that are non-standard user interface elements accessible, whereas previously they couldn't be. So in that sense, things have got a lot better. But as I say, that the complexity does breed new issues. But they're new challenges, and we just, you know, face them and find out a way to fix them.
So you do a good deal of work with W3C working groups and task forces. What about that work interests you?
Well, the main thing that interests me is that I have the opportunity to influence and contribute to defining the standards that define the web and how it communicates. For probably about 7 years now, I've been involved in the HTML working group at the W3C, and HTML is the language of the web. Every web page is written in HTML, and a lot of the information that's communicated to users with disabilities that have to use assistive technology, that information is communicated through the HTML content and structures that are defined within the HTML specification. So to be able to contribute to the further development of the HTML language is both an honor and a very exciting privilege.
What about the work you're doing right now with the HTML spec? I see a lot going on about that.
Okay, so it's got to do with process within the W3C. The specifications proceed along a particular track. They're initially published as working drafts, and then they're reviewed and further work is done on those. And so they get input from implementers, and anybody is free to actually provide feedback. And that feedback is taken into account. The editors make changes to the documents. At the same time, new features are being added as either the things that implementers are thinking, well, we want to have this feature, or developers have developed some custom feature that is popular, and then it becomes standardized. And so there's all these things constantly being drawn into the specification. At the same time, what they're trying to do is stabilize the specification at a particular point to get it through the W3C standardization process. So it goes through an iterative process of feedback, editing, and then moving to the next stage. And what the stage we're at in the current process for HTML 5.0, you could call it, is that we've reached what is last call. And that means that what's in the specification, in the HTML 5.0 specification, is fairly stable and all the requirements are there and the features are there. There's not going to be any new features added to HTML 5.0. And so there's a last call, which means that people get to provide some feedback. And then once that feedback's been dealt with, then it moves to proposed recommendation. And then ultimately to become a recommendation where what the content of that is set in stone. And so we'll have the HTML 5.0 recommendation. But at the same time, we are working on the HTML 5.1 recommendation, which is essentially a superset of what's in the HTML 5.0 specification plus new features. And so things are being added in parallel. So there's a number of different versions of the document. There's the more stable version, which eventually locked down, and then there's the continuing 5.1 spec, and that will go through the same process. And I think that in 2016, it's set to again go through this process of becoming a proposed recommendation. But in the meantime, we'll start working on a 5.2, so there'll be further extensions. So it's a living language, and things are constantly being added. And also that what is written in the specification is essentially a set of rules for how browsers are supposed to implement that, browsers being Chrome, Firefox, etc., are supposed to implement the features defined in the specification. So, you know, if you're familiar with HTML, all of the HTML elements and attributes are all defined, and what they do is defined within the specification, and how they're supposed to be implemented is defined in the specification. And then as well as that, there's a lot of what we call implementer requirements. There's also requirements on authors how to use the particular features of HTML. And that's where I have a lot of interest, is defining the author requirements, because how authors use HTML affects the accessibility of HTML. So if authors misuse the features, you know, write the code incorrectly, don't use headings in the appropriate way, don't mark up tables, you know, as data tables correctly with the using the correct features, then that has a negative effect upon end users, especially users with disabilities. So I have a lot of interest in, I spend a lot of time working on the text of the specification in those areas in particular.
I see. So you're focusing on the authoring aspects of the specs primarily?
Yeah, that's primarily what I do. But I also obviously review and feedback with implementers about aspects of the implementations, but mainly in regards to the accessibility of the implementation. So if a particular feature is a new control, but it doesn't describe how it's going to be used by someone with a keyboard, for example, or it doesn't seem to have those sort of hooks in there to be able to make it keyboard accessible or provide an accessible name, a label appropriately for it, then the process is we file bugs against the specification, but also that when things get implemented, we file bugs upon the software itself. So I spend quite a bit of time filing bugs against Chrome and Firefox and Internet Explorer and Safari to say, well, this is supposed to be implemented this way, but you've implemented it in some other way and it's made it less accessible. So let's try to get it implemented as it's defined in the specification. Or if the way it's defined in the specification is wrong for particular reasons, then provide some information about the reasons and we can see if we can change the specification to fit the reality.
Oh, okay. So you're looking out for accessibility as the specification is built out and how it's kind of supported within the browsers.
Well, that's right. Yeah. I mean, over the last week, I've done a lot of testing. As I was saying, this process of going through this recommendation process, one of the criteria for the specification to become a recommendation is that what is defined as a requirement upon browsers for a particular implementation requirement is tested. And so you need to write tests and you test that the assertions in the specification are actually implemented as they're asserted in the specification. And there's a fairly big section of the specification that defines how the roles, states and properties for HTML elements are supposed to be exposed by the browsers within the XSP APIs within the software. So a browser must, you know, in simple terms, if you have a button element, that button element must be exposed with a role of button within the appropriate XSP API. This is by the browser. So I need to go in and check that assertion is actually being supported within the browsers. And so you create some files, you check, you use some software that looks at what the XSP information is, and in the case of a button element, is it exposing a role of button? And happily, it is. But you can imagine that just for the accessibility aspects, it's, you know, there's a lot of testing. But that is a similar model that's used for the whole specification. And remembering the HTML specification is, I don't know, 600, 800 pages long, with lots and lots of assertions in there. There's hundreds of thousands of tests that need to be written and tested. And there's a big effort within the W3C and within the development community to create these tests and do the testing to show what the HTML specification defines is in line with what is implemented in browsers.
I seem to remember just reading somewhere along the way that in order for a specification to be finalized, that it needs to be fully implemented in two browsers. Is that correct?
Yeah. What are known as the exit criteria, where the thing can pass, they're not always the same across specifications, but pretty much the rule of thumb is that if the browser has an assertion in there that says that X must do Y, then that assertion needs to be implemented in two browsers, at least two. Obviously, more the better. But the whole idea is to get the features of HTML implemented interoperably. So implemented in the same way in multiple pieces of software.
Sounds like a pretty rigorous process.
Well, it can be, yeah. It's a lot of time consuming, a lot of people spending time in this thankless task, that's for sure.
We're all very thankful that you're doing it, just so you know.
Thank you. As always, what's wonderful about doing this work is you're working in a large community of people. And, you know, a lot of people are just giving their time and knowledge to improve the web.
It's pretty impressive. So another specification that you have worked on quite a deal is the Way ARIA spec. Could you tell us a bit about that specification and what that's for and the role of that moving forward as this new HTML spec comes into play?
Sure. I will prefix that by saying that I have been involved with the development of the Way ARIA specification, but my main work has been in integrating the HTML specification and the appropriate bits of the ARIA specification. The majority of the work for that specification is some wonderful other folk with the accessibility community. As I was explaining before about the button element has a button role, and that role is conveyed or is hooked up in the software by the browser. Previous to ARIA coming along, there was no way for an author to, say, set that button role within the browser. What ARIA has done is allowed authors to set that information, to expose that information, to say, hey, this is a role equals button, and then the browser then sends that information to the XSP API, and so is exposed correctly within the XSP API. Now, for most HTML elements, you don't need to do this because the browsers do it automatically. But as we mentioned previously, what we have is a lot of development of custom widgets, things that aren't represented as native HTML controls, being developed using quite often non-interactive HTML elements that have no meaning within themselves, like divs and spans, or building on top of native controls that do have meaning, such as elements and such as anchor or link elements and buttons and things like that, but actually adding to their functionality and changing the meaning of what they are. Whereas before ARIA, you couldn't do anything about that. Well, it was very difficult to convey the changing meaning that the author has imposed upon it through the use of scripting and the coding. With ARIA, if you change a link into a button, not saying that you should do that, but people often do it, that you can through the use of ARIA role states and properties, you can provide that information that to let the user know that, hey, this is not actually a link, it's a button, and you can interact with it as a button. So, you know, it does button-like things, not link-like things.
So when you look at that specification, are there things happening within the new HTML spec that would change how ARIA is used?
To a certain extent. There are some of the newer HTML features, such as the dialogue element, which didn't make it into 5.0 because it hasn't been implemented. Well, it's implemented in one browser, but it's not interoperably being implemented. And it was very unlikely that it was going to be implemented within the timescale of the 5.0 specification becoming a recommendation. But it is still present and living on in the 5.1 specification. Now, the dialogue element, as the name implies, provides a native dialogue control. So instead of having to script divs and spans to make it look like a dialogue, you can use the dialogue element and it has more of the features of a dialogue. Some of the interaction that you need to script in for custom dialogues is actually already built in. So for example, when you open the dialogue and you have a modal dialogue using the dialogue element, the keyboard interaction is that the keyboard interaction will stay inside the modal dialogue until the dialogue is closed. Whereas with custom elements, custom dialogues, you have to actually use scripting to actually listen for the events and control the behavior of the keyboard behavior via scripting. So good thing is that with the dialogue, you no longer have to do that once it's implemented. Another thing is that, like most user interface elements, that has a role, and with custom elements that, as I said, with the advent of ARIA, you could add a role as well as all the other things you need to do. So you could represent it as what it is. But with a built-in native dialogue element, you don't have to do that. And, you know, there's other things like the visual effects that you get. You know, you get this dimming of the screen behind. You get those automatically. So it just makes it a lot simpler for developers to create the things that they're already creating using divs and spans and CSS and JavaScript trickery. It's done natively in the browser just by simply having the dialogue element and controlling the display of that element.
So that sounds great. Less trickery.
Yeah, less quackery even.
So do you see a time where way ARIA would be obsolete in the sense that there would be native elements that make those additional attributes that way ARIA brings to the process unnecessary?
No.
Okay. Why not?
Well, the reason being is that there is a lot of controls that come in and fall out of favor, but they're never actually standardized. Not everything, not every type of UI control will be standardized and implemented. So there'll always be room for the use of ARIA or reasons the need to use ARIA. Also, just note that, you know, one of the things I always like to say is that people, you know, see ARIA as a bridging technology, that at some point everything will be wonderful and we'll have native support for all of these interactions and role states and properties. But when we look at, for example, the humble button, as I was mentioning earlier, that the button element has been around since 94. So we're talking about 20 years. And still today, people are building buttons out of any other element you can think of but a button. I'm not saying that's correct, and they should be doing that, but they do it. And there's no way to stop them doing it because, you know, part of the integral features of HTML is that you can, every element, whether it be a control or a paragraph element, can have interaction and events associated with it. And so if it can, then people will do it. Another aspect is that the focus of ARIA is shifting to a certain extent, in the sense that instead of just becoming this bridging technology, it's starting to become the abstract sort of layer, the way that accessibility semantics are described. They're starting to be used as the generic sort of way to describe the accessibility semantics for a number of languages. What happens is that if you have an ARIA button role, that actually equates or maps to a number of accessible APIs is coded into various platforms and browsers. And so in that sense, it's being used more as a generic identifier these days. So even if its usefulness as a way to plug gaps in native functionality, that it's got a different usefulness within itself. To give you a clearer example, or to give you an example even, the way that the requirements for HTML elements, the accessibility mappings that they require, are couched in terms of ARIA requirements. So in the specification, it doesn't say a button element needs to have a button role in accessibility API X, Y, or Z on platform, you know, X. It says it needs to have a button role, an ARIA button role. So it's just describing in terms of ARIA. And then because ARIA provides that mapping information through a sister specification to the ARIA specification called the ARIA implementation guide. And so that has the nuts and bolts of how a ARIA button role equates to a button in Safari on the Mac, for example, what role that equates to. So I don't know if I'm getting it across, but it's saying it's like a dictionary of terms that are defined for a variety of platforms and software. So on the one hand, you have that usefulness of ARIA, but on the other hand, you also have ARIA, like other specifications, is still in development. The 1.0 version of ARIA has been shipped, but there is currently work on 1.1, ARIA 1.1, which is in active development. And there's work around, for example, extending ARIA properties to be able to describe annotation information. So, for example, currently there's no way for me as an author to adequately define if I've crossed something out, you know, using a line through or whatever in a word processing program. There's no way for me to actually convey that unambiguously to an assist technology user through the accessibility API because there's no semantics for that that are clearly available. And so what they're looking into and developing in ARIA 1.1 is additional attributes that will allow you to describe all those sorts of things like footnotes and comments, etc., that typically we're used to using within Word documents and things like that or on the web. You'll be able to use ARIA to provide the clear and ambiguous descriptions for those things. And also, as you know, there's new roles and states that are being developed. One of the new controls that has become ubiquitous, especially on mobile, is the toggle button. You know, the switch is another word for it. And that previously there hasn't been a role for that type of control, and there's roles being added for that and for some other things. And so there's further refinements and additions as new things get invented. The other aspect of, you know, talking about things becoming native in HTML, one of the exciting and also potentially problematic from an accessibility standpoint is the new developments within what is known as web components. And this is a whole suite of applications that essentially allow developers to create new elements, so new HTML elements that they can use in their pages and add new functionality. So, you know, think of them like it's like they're supercharged custom controls, like supercharged jQuery, but they allow developers to do all these great new things. But a lot of the accessibility semantics, a lot of the information that will be required to be provided will need ARIA to be able to do it. So if anything, ARIA is becoming more important and more integral to the story for the HTML going forward rather than becoming less important.
It seems like that these things will move forward kind of in tandem, one supporting the other. How is ARIA support on mobile devices? So like for that switch, for example, that's used a lot in iOS. The little on-off switch, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously for something like that, which hasn't been, is still being specified, there is no support. But in general, the differences, the problems associated with the support for accessibility in general in various devices is that there's a different browser culture within mobile devices than there is in the desktop. There's more, you know, on the desktop you have the four major browsers, depending upon the device that you're using. Say if you use an iOS device, you essentially, on the surface, you might have Chrome and WebKit and even Firefox. I don't know if you can get a Firefox for iOS, but underneath it, the iOS platform, the rendering engine, the engine that's actually powers the browser, is the WebKit engine, which is the Safari browser engine. And so it's much more dependent upon one vendor or one browser engine implementing something. But on the desktop, Chrome isn't that great and IE is pretty shabby, but then Firefox is great and WebKit on OS X is great as far as accessibility support. So you've got some choice. But where you have the more controlled environments of the mobile, then things not necessarily good. I mean, but having said that, then WebKit and Apple on both iOS and OS X, you know, they put a lot of work into it. They're obviously, it's not perfect, but they put a lot of work into it. But in a general sense, you would find that the accessory support for ARIA implementation is a little bit behind on the mobile devices for a variety of reasons.
Recently, I read somewhere on the Twitters or something that the alt attribute on images isn't required for validation with the new HTML specification. Did I get that right?
Well, not exactly, no. But within HTML5, the alt attribute is required. To have a conforming document, you need to have an alt attribute with an appropriate text alternative on every image element, except in the cases where you have an image element that is contained within a figure element that has a non-empty fig caption element. Essentially, it means that if you have a caption for an image, you don't need an alt attribute necessarily. It's quite a refined rule, and it's quite narrow in its scope. And what it's designed to do is to reflect the reality of situations like where you have image upload sites, where you have, you know, photo sites, where you have people uploading thousands of images with no desire to add text alternatives to each of them, or oftentimes no time, or, you know, there will no opportunity to do that. And so at least that if you have a caption, you have something that identifies that image. And if you have something that identifies the image and gives some information about the image, that if you had an empty alt on there, which is what in the past that people have put on there, what that essentially does is say this image is of no interest to the assist technology user. And with HTML5, with the implementation of the HTML5 semantics for images with an empty alt, it will mean it will no longer be represented in the accessibility tree if it has an empty alt on it. So it's a way of saying this image has some, or may have some, information of interest, but it doesn't have a text alternative, but it does have a caption. So it tells you something about the image and that the image is there. Where if you put an empty alt on there, then it would just disappear.
I think I got that. I understand the use case. So you're saying I have an image and I have a caption, and so that will be wrapped in this figure element. And because it's within the figure element, it knows that it has a caption and so doesn't feel as though the image needs to be described in any way. It's essentially like automatically adding null alt text to the image.
Yeah. The spec doesn't say the image doesn't need to be described. It's saying that the image, the spec's quite clear in that it says that if there's any chance at all that the image can be provided with an appropriate text alternative, it must be provided. It's just that the reality is that quite often it's not. But what's happened in the past is that quite often when it's not, that either software or authors just put an empty alt tag on there. And in doing that, then they're essentially hiding the image and the user's not going to know there's an image there at all, even if they wanted to interrogate it.
Okay.
So, you know, they won't know. So they can't even say to their mate, you know, hey, there's an image here. You've got a pair of eyes. Can you tell me what it is? Because they won't know the image is there. Previously, a way to provide the caption for an image was via the title attribute. number of problems with this is that the title attribute itself doesn't carry the semantics of a caption, and also that the title attribute has various problems the way it's implemented in browsers, that if on mobile you don't see it, you can't actually access the title attribute anyway. Or if you're using a keyboard, you are hiding information. With the use of the figure and fig caption pattern, what you're doing is providing a programmatically associated, because the figure wraps around the image and the caption. So you're saying these things are associated, and you're providing a visible label for the image so the user knows something about the image.
Nice.
I like it.
It sounds like a really elegant way to present the design pattern in a consistent way. Hopefully it will lead to more accurate and descriptive and helpful descriptions of images since it displays on the page.
That's the hope. I mean, one of the issues is just getting people to provide a text alternative full stop, rather than, I mean, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, get them to provide some text and then make that text an appropriate text alternative, you know, make it actually useful and meaningful. You know, each step is a little bit harder to make. But the thing is, at least quite often, you know, what's happened in the past is that a text alternative will be provided using the alt attribute. Won't actually be a text alternative. It'll be what is semantically a caption. So now we have a caption element that you can actually provide a caption for something. So, you know, it has a different meaning and it has a prescribed meaning that's actually conveyed. So, for example, in Firefox, the fig caption element is exposed with a role of caption. So that can be conveyed to the user. So they get told that this is a caption. This text, you know, is a caption. It's not a text alternative or a replacement for the image.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's what I was just thinking, that captions might have a really different function than a text alternative.
Well, they do in most circumstances, but at least if people aren't going to provide the text alternative, but they are going to provide a caption, at least the user knows that this is a caption and it's a caption for something that's not, you know, adequately described.
It sounds like you can really look at the specifications, like this is an instance where you're looking at the real world and thinking about how things are implemented and the process for putting images on pages and stuff like that. When you're working on specifications, do you talk a lot about the implications of changes on processes? So in this case, you know, we spend a lot of time in accessibility talking to people about creating good text alternatives for images, and this adds a little twist to that. And is that part of the spec development process, thinking about the cultural impacts of these things?
I think it definitely is. I mean, but I suppose the thing is, a lot of things that make it into the HTML specification, just like other specifications, is that they look at the way authors use HTML in the wild, and they look at, you know, design patterns that are used and say, well, let's formalize that design pattern. The provision of a caption for an image is, well, it's not ubiquitous, but there's a lot of, you know, I mean, in the print media, there's, you know, for academic textbooks and anything, you know, that have captions. Newspapers and online news media, they have captions for images. There's a lot of circumstances where you have a visible piece of text that is associated with a particular image. Previously, there was no way to actually say, hey, this is a caption for this image. Now there is. So it's really just sort of, as is said, formalizing things that, you know, or design patterns or code structures that developers have been using.
Well, as someone who builds things and evaluates things that other people build, I find it really reassuring that the web standards people are looking at what's happening and adapting the standard to support it. I think that's great.
Well, that's, yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I've been particularly interested in. There's been some big changes over the last 10 years in the way that the HTML specification in particular has been developed and how things get added and what gets described. But a large part of that has been a renewal of browser implementation information and ensuring that that is correct and working closely with the browser vendors and things like that. But the authoring guidance within the specification has not kept pace, and the same rigor and real-world perspective hasn't been applied to that. And that's one of the things that I've tried to do since I've been involved, is actually get information, author guidance in the specification to actually reflect both the constraints and the best practices that are in the real world. I mean, to give you an example, one of the new features in HTML5 is, or it's new, it's been around for a while now, is the placeholder attribute, which is essentially allows you to define a piece of text that is displayed within a text edit field or text area in a control. You know, the sort of thing that's usually, you know, light gray and difficult to read and then disappears. But it's a feature that a lot of people were doing via scripting. You could use JavaScript to change the value of the control. And so to have that, and it's also a feature that's available on other platforms, you know, desktop platforms, etc. So it's been added to HTML. But one of the things that I wanted to ensure is that the advice around the use of that is clear, that it should not be abused. It shouldn't be used as a label in place of a visible label. Now, we can't always stop people doing that. And at the same time as not wanting to have it used as a visible label, one of the things that I think is important and have worked and tested is that in the absence of any other label text, that it is exposed as a label through the Accessibility APIs to assist technology users. So at least, again, a realistic point, they get some information. But at the same time, in the specification, which echoes information that is provided by people like, you know, usability gurus like Nielsen Group, that you shouldn't use a placeholder as a replacement for a label. And it states that clearly in the specification as author guidance, and, you know, states the reasons why, because it's problems with the color, that it disappears, so it has an effect on users with cognitive impairments, etc. You know, there's a whole litany of reasons why it's not a good idea. And those are clearly stated within the specification, which is the sort of thing that wasn't there, but I've been working to get in to the specification, because I think that even though this HTML specification is meant to be primarily for browser implementers, it's also looked to and used and is a valuable resource for HTML authors and developers, etc.
Well, I know I speak for many, many people in thanking you for bringing that perspective into the development of the specifications and all of the hard work you and everyone else who's involved in developing these specifications put in. So thanks very much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
It's been very informative and enlightening.
I hope I haven't gabbled on too much. I tend to gabble, especially when I'm sitting alone in my hallway talking to people.
It's good gabbling. Let me just put it that way.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much, Sarah. I had an enjoyable time speaking with you today.
This has been Steve Faulkner sharing insights on how specifications like HTML5 and WayAria are there to help us in building a web for everyone. Many thanks to you for listening, and to our sponsors, UIE, Rosenfeld Media, the Passiello Group, and O'Reilly, for making this podcast possible. Follow us at A Web for Everyone on Twitter. That's at A Web for Everyone. Until next time.
Thanks for joining us for A Podcast for Everyone. This series is a companion to the book A Web for Everyone, co-authored by Sarah Horton and Whitney Quisenberry. Be sure to tell us what you want to learn next at awebforeveryone@gmail.com. This podcast series is brought to you by UIE's All You Can Learn. UIE's All You Can Learn will give you the skills and techniques you need for a competitive design advantage with 24/7 access to UX experts and topics. Rosenfeld Media. Rosenfeld Media offers unequaled UX expertise in print and in person. Their experts consult, teach, and write books like A Web for Everyone. The Passiello Group. The Passiello Group helps organizations make their technology accessible to everyone, including people with disabilities. As always, thanks for listening.